Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, October 9th, 2023. I'm Lou DeVizio. This week on the podcast, I'm excited to introduce for the first time as a New Mexico in Focus correspondent, journalist Nash Jones. There's a good chance you'll recognize Nash's voice from the show All Things Considered and from reported pieces on KUNM Radio. That's their full-time gig. But this week, Nash hosts a special roundtable to talk about why government agencies continue to struggle with hiring and retaining employees in the wake of the COVID pandemic. Joining Nash are the Cabinet Secretary for the Department of Workforce Solutions, the Acting Director of the State Personnel Office, the Acting HR Director for the City of Albuquerque, and a Public Employee Union President. That conversation's coming up in about 15 minutes. That's after a discussion between correspondent Antonia Gonzalez and two indigenous community leaders about last month's shooting at the planned site for a Juan de Oñate statue in Española. Antonia and her two guests also get into some of the necessary context surrounding the violent history at colonial monuments like the Oñate statue. For now, let's get into the headlines around the state. State District Court judge has ruled that congressional boundaries the Democrat-controlled New Mexico legislature drew up and pushed through do not violate the state constitution. That's despite him acknowledging that the redistricting diluted Republican voting power. Now, Republicans have vowed to appeal the decision. At particular issue in the lawsuit is CD2, a swing district that, in part, skirts the U.S.-Mexico border. In 2022, Democrat Gabe Vasquez narrowly defeated first-term Republican incumbent Yvette Harrell by less than a percentage point. Judge Fred Van Solen ruled that while the plan from the Democratic lawmakers watered down the GOP's chances, they did not egregiously gerrymander. He says there isn't enough evidence that the redrawn districts unfairly secured long-term power for Democrats. This ruling is sure to make a splash on the national stage as Republicans aim to maintain their slim majority in the U.S. House after the upcoming 2024 elections. CD2 has seen some of the tightest races in the country during the last few election cycles. Right now, Democrats hold all statewide elected offices in New Mexico and all three congressional seats. A judge has sentenced Lalo Anthony Castrillo to a mandatory prison term of 30 years to life for intentionally causing the death of 2-year-old Fabiola Rodriguez. But now, just days later, attention turns to potential appeal efforts, with Castrillo's lawyer saying he'll focus on several issues that came up during the September trial, most of them related to the jury. Last month, a jury convicted Castrillo of intentionally abusing the child known as Baby Fabi, resulting in death by blunt force trauma to her head. But before that verdict was issued, there were several juror-related issues that threatened to disrupt the proceedings. Castrillo's attorney, Jose Coronado, explained these concerns to the Las Cruces Sun News, including one juror's report of offensive comments from another juror, though it's not exactly clear what was said. At one point, another juror brought her baby to court because of childcare conflicts, and in a separate incident, a different juror prematurely declared Castrillo's guilt after only a single day of testimony. That juror had also complained about the effect of the room's temperature on his health. Coronado says, after taking all of these incidents into account, the integrity of the jury's decision should come into question, but he says he's waiting for additional court filings before he moves forward with an appeal. It's been more than a week since Ryan David Martinez allegedly shot peaceful demonstrator Jacob Johns at the site of a planned reinstallation of a Juan de Oñate statue. New Mexico in Focus correspondent Antonia Gonzalez got a chance to speak with two eyewitnesses to ask how the indigenous community is recovering from the traumatic violence and to give some historical context on what Oñate represents for their people.
Nathana and Janine, welcome to New Mexico in Focus. First, I'd like to acknowledge that the gun violence in itself was traumatizing, and also acknowledge the deep historical trauma that Native people face, but also just how important this discussion is to have. So I want to thank you again for joining us today. And Nathana, you were there. Tell us about the day.
So we were there from the beginning of the day. I was there from the morning. Participated in sunrise ceremony that morning, where many folks from the community led us in prayer and led us in song, and also the victim, Jacob Johns, also led us in a song that morning. Participating in the speaking engagements that day, so I stayed to the peripheral, really kind of taking a look for folks' safety and making note of where folks were at. So some of the other opposition folks, or the folks in opposition, also had started to leave. So the group started getting smaller and smaller. There was two older men, one with a MAGA hat, and another older gentleman was walking along the sidewalk with the shooter. And also alongside of them, it was them three and then one of my friends. My friends was walking alongside with them on the sidewalk, and I knew something wasn't right. The two gentlemen were alongside of the wall, the bigger wall, stucco wall, along the sidewalk. And I saw the alleged shooter run or like try to charge into the space where we were at, which was near the gravel area. And I just saw him take a right. He ran, he tried to jump the wall. He jumped over the wall. And at that point, everybody started just scuffling with him, trying to get him out of the space. And then that's when they had him up against the wall. He flipped over, got flipped over the wall, and then he stood up and immediately he picked up his jacket and pulled out his gun. And at that point, I just was like, oh, like I just cussed. I was like, oh shit, I gotta get out of here. My immediate reaction was to duck. And so I went for cover, I ducked. I came up on the other side of the altar, I stood up, and the first thing that was going through my head was like, where's my partner? Somebody got shot. I heard immediately the cry out for help. I heard the bullet go, the gunshot go off, and I ducked. I went around the corner. I was thinking, like, if this happened, like, if he comes around this side, how am I going to protect myself? Where is everybody? And I stood up immediately, and at that point, he was already running to his car and had gotten in his car and was driving off. My partner was running to the car. My partner was recording at the time, and so I immediately ran towards the ran towards that area, and then at that point, everybody was like calling 911. Everybody called 911, and so I called 911, but my phone wasn't ringing, so I hung up and I tried again, and I called 911, and I got through, and they said that they were on their way. And it was just everything just happened so quickly. It was just awful. It was definitely something that forever is like a life altering experience.
Well, I'm glad you're safe, and thank you for sharing that. And Janine, you were also there. What has your life been like since the event?
We switched after Jacob was able to get medical attention, which wasn't until 10, 15 minutes later. When the paramedics finally arrived, when he finally was able to get the appropriate medical attention, we switched into having to do our own work to ensure that the witnesses were safe, that we're recording witness statements, that we were collecting information from everybody. We even switched to smudging everyone off because, like I said, this was a prayerful event. And we rely very strongly on our medicines and our traditional ways to protect our people. And so I went around like smudging people, especially the children and the woman that were extremely traumatized because this is a family event. And people were like, especially the children, were very traumatized by this type of violence being brought into such a beautiful, prayerful, and loving space. And so since then, you know, we don't have the luxury to rest. We've been having to fight a narrative war that has been trying to frame this as if there was some element of danger in our taking a stand and having this prayerful gathering. When really the danger wasn't coming from us, the danger was coming from these right-wing extremists and agitators who felt compelled enough to come armed with weapons, with guns, with knives, and to heckle and harass the gathering of people that were there. And even though police saw this, and even though they escorted Ryan off at one time prior, they allowed him to come back in. And so this was unacceptable, and having to process those things, having to process the fact that they allowed the rest of the agitators to leave the space before an arrest was made, before interviews were taken, all of that I think has really made it hard to feel safe for any of our organizers and any of the people there, despite Ryan being arrested, because it does need to be investigated who he was in collaboration and relationship with, because this was a premeditated hate crime.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I also want to talk about the historical context. Nathana, what does the Oñate statue mean in particular to you, to Pueblo people, to Okeowinge, which the statue was originally next to your community?
For me, Oñate personally represents the brutality that was put up against our people, right? Our Pueblo people, we fought years and decades to really keep this sort of like dismantling of our communities out of our communities. We really have seen through history just the documentation of how the genocide, the cultural washing, or the banning of traditional practices was done by folks that were brought to really colonize our communities. And so Oñate was sort of like the lead in that piece, along with other folks that came before him. And so it was basically to colonize and to convert Native people. And so a lot of our historical documents really state that there was a lot of destruction, there was a lot of violence, there was greed. A lot of our folks were really pushed to convert, and also a lot of just violence against our women, sexual violence, enslavement of our people. And so now it's really trying to figure out, like, knowing that there's this history that exists in our community, and knowing that we're all sort of in this community together, is how do we really start to grapple with the way that colonization and the way that these folks came in and took our community years ago, generations ago, and it still lingers here. But how do we really sort of have these conversations of, yes, we are acknowledging history, and yes, history does tell a story of how this impacted our communities. We still carry that.
Janine, Indian Collective advocates nationally, internationally even. So across the country, when there's opposition to, say, Confederate statues, there's often an acknowledgement about that history, including slavery. So why is it that something like this may not be understood more widely in the public, especially when it comes to Native American history?
The lack of education around the true history of this country, and the whitewashing of the education of our general public. You know, like, we have behind a lot of this right wing extremism and this white supremacy rhetoric that is rampant throughout our country, is this belief that they're the true patriots, they're the true Americans. And it's ironic, because if they really did believe that, you would think they would uphold and understand that the establishment of this country was only enabled through treaties with indigenous peoples. We were never conquered. That's one of those things that those myths of colonial whitewashing of our history that needs to be pushed back upon in every setting. As brutal as these colonizers were, and Oñate represents some of the most brutal crimes of colonization, so much so that the Spanish crown is the one that banished him from this area. They didn't even want anything to do with him. So it's ironic that they want to continue to try to resurrect him as a symbol of what makes them proud to be Americans and New Mexicans even, when even that his reputation is not even accepted or upheld by the country that he was supposedly representing during his conquest. And so, like, when we talk about what we're fighting for and the solutions that indigenous peoples are bringing to the table, those solutions are enabled by upholding our right to sovereignty and self-determination, rights which were never taken away, but that are embedded in the very constitution of this country as the supreme law of the land. And we need all Americans to understand that, and understand that because of that, we were never conquered. That is why we are still here as sovereign nations. That is why our rights are both nation rights and collective rights, to both our unique spiritual, political, and economic ways of living and of creating systems of governance and systems of community, and why we will continue to push forward and uphold those rights, because they maintain the pathway for real solutions for sustainable, whole, safe communities. And we won't accept anything less. Because we're not just resisting, we're building solutions in our communities. We're bringing solutions in our communities. That our ability to create and support organizers that have a whole breadth of expertise from laws to economics to policies, we know that we have what is needed to help create and craft solutions that benefit not only Indigenous peoples, but all peoples and our Mother Earth. And that is why our fight will never die, and why we will never give up, and why we will continue to persist even in the face of this type of violence, because we do not act out of fear. We do not allow these acts of violence to perpetuate fear in our communities or to perpetuate cycles of trauma, because we come from generations of cycle breakers and of people who have resisted this in all of its brutal forms throughout history to still remain here in our homelands, carrying on these worldviews, our languages, our spiritual and traditional teachings, and we will continue to do so for future generations to come.
Well, thank you for sharing the resilience of Indigenous people and for being here on New Mexico PBS today. Thank you both.
Thank you to Antonia Gonzalez for her interview along with both of our guests. You can read a statement from the family of Jacob Johns, the victim in last week's shooting, linked on our social media pages. Now to our new correspondent, Nash Jones, and their roundtable discussion on the lingering public employee shortage and its impact here in New Mexico. Joining Nash around the table are Dylan Lang, acting director of the State Personnel Office, Casey Padilla, president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME, Council 18, which covers New Mexico and Colorado, and Sarita Nair, secretary of the New Mexico Department of Workforce Solutions. Here's Nash.
The public sector, both nationally and here in New Mexico, has not recovered from pandemic-driven staffing losses. Dylan, your agency has been tracking this on the statewide level. What exactly are you seeing in terms of vacancy rates? And for folks who don't know, what kinds of jobs are we talking about?
Thank you, Nash. The State Personnel Office, we are responsible for the administration and oversight of the state personnel classified system, and it consists of about 18,000 state employees with approximately 68 state agencies and boards and commissions. And so if you think about, well, who is a state employee, it's really the gambit of services that are provided by the state. I have a 5-year-old son and a 1.5-year-old son, and they have little community helpers, right? And that's really who our state employees are. They are contractors, they are mechanics, they are attorneys, they are engineers, they're scientists. And so that's really who we're talking about, direct care services in nursing. So that's who we're talking about when we talk about state employees. And new data came out that we do have, 23.8% vacancy rate in the state.
Okay.
And to put that in context, that's kind of right in the middle. It's a little bit higher than we want here at the state, but some states have as less as 10% vacancy rate and others high as 30. So we're kind of right in the middle. There's a lot of causes for the vacancy rate, which, you know, I think we can get into, but some of the positions I thought you might ask about where we're seeing vacancies in the state, and I kind of printed off a couple of jobs that might be, you know, meaningful to individuals to understand, with at least 30 positions in the state where there's a higher vacancy rate than 30%. Okay. And first is epidemiologists, right? There's a 62% vacancy rate, 24 positions in the state. We're actively trying to fill those jobs and fill those rates, but, you know, we did look at the salary and we are paying more to epidemiologists than the state government survey average. Other states around the country, we were actually paying them $2,000 more.
Okay. So epidemiologists are well above the average in terms of the vacancy rate, but on average, you're seeing about almost 25% vacancy rate. Is that right?
In the state, for sure. In the state.
I am interested in beyond the state. Sarita, do you have a sense of what we're seeing in terms of vacancies at the local level, at cities and counties across New Mexico?
Sure, and thanks for having us, Nash. First off, I think for the big picture, what we see right now is a strong economy. But what I think businesses of all types are feeling right now is what we call the estimated employment gap. And that's the difference between the number of people who are unemployed and the current job posting. So right now, there's about a 34,400 person estimated employment gap, which means if everyone who is unemployed and looking for a job got a job tomorrow, there'd still be 34,400 vacancies. So then when we take that down to the government level, government as a whole has basically recovered from the pandemic. So we hit that mark for state government in about June, and now we're up about 1,300 jobs from pre-pandemic. But who's really feeling it is local government. They're still 5,400 jobs short of a full recovery from the pandemic.
And when we're talking local, both city and towns and municipalities, but also at the county level?
Cities, counties, and local schools.
Okay. Well, with that being kind of the scope of the problem that we are looking at tonight, I also want to talk about what's fueling it, right? Casey, AFSCME has launched a national recruitment campaign. Can you talk a bit about what you see as the problem here? I mean, what's the recruitment campaign responding to?
Well, pretty much it's, you know, and I think, you know, you're trying, it's expanded to just hear from here, right? It's basically across the nation, right? And that's kind of what AFSCME was doing. They had a bus tour, right, that I think you were, mm-hmm. you're a part of. And they're going across the nation, and they're seeing these vacancy rates you know, trying to come up with a way of why, what's going on with it, right? And why aren't people applying? You know, I think Sarita mentioned that even if they all filled, everybody went and got a job, there'd still be a vacancy rate there, right? So we're still trying to just sort through any information we can get to kind of see, like, what's going on with it, you know, because, you know, some of the things that we're seeing now, some of the jobs that people are looking for are more convenience, right? Like working from home, you know, some of the jobs were able to do that during the pandemic. I think some of the employees enjoyed that as a benefit, right? You have Uber now. You have these different jobs where they can just hit an app and they work the hours they want to when they don't want to, you know, but we're still in the process of, you know.
So convenience being one. Anything else that you're seeing as potentially a big piece of this?
Well, I think it could be. I think, you know, like specifically like with the city of Albuquerque, they're doing a class and comp study. Like he stated that some of their pay rates or compensations higher than any other areas. We're kind of working on that same aspect to kind of see if that's an issue also to see where we are competitively, right?
So. Okay. So convenience, pay. Dylan, the State Personnel Office that you direct recently completed a report that touched on some of what's driving these shortages. Can you talk about what was illuminated as important and whether what Casey's talking about is resonating at all with what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, we haven't really talked about the recruitment process, but I mean, those are some hurdles here. But what Mr. Padilla was talking about, you know, we are seeing that, and State Personnel Office is trying to attack the classification issues that may be bound hurdles to attract more competitive candidates.
So we've done classifications.
Yeah, just basically what jobs do, the job duties, and how much you can pay individual classifications of employees. So we're going to be doing a classification study on attorneys, right, to make sure that we can pay them competitively. We just did one for forensic scientists, you know, at DPS, so we can pay them more at what the market is allowing them to pay. We also did one for HR staff, right? It's some of these harder areas to fill if we allow ourselves the flexibility to offer more competitive salaries, we hope, you know, to attract individuals to come into those positions in the state. And we have seen the state has increased the amount of out-of-state employees, they're still New Mexicans, out-of-state employees coming into the state system. So we had more in FY23 than 22. So we are hiring people. It's just we also are creating more and more jobs at positions, I guess, to say. And we just have to get people in those positions now.
Well, and I would just add that the data actually bears both of you out in the sense that state government jobs actually pay more than the average New Mexican wage, average about $66,000 a year, whereas local government jobs do not. They pay about $51,000 a year on average. So again, you can see that disparity in those numbers as well.
And why is that? And if I might, what would it look like for local government in this particular instance to simply pay people more?
Well, you know, having been at both levels of government, I can say that the local government jobs are frontline in a way that most state jobs are not. So during the pandemic, trash truck drivers couldn't work from home, paramedics, firefighters, cops, there just wasn't that level of flexibility. But also local governments didn't get, except for the city of Albuquerque and Bernalillo County, no local government in the state got direct aid through the CARES Act or through the American Rescue Plan. And so they all had to face really difficult decisions about cutbacks and, you know, falling revenue and all those things without any support. And so I think that's how we ended up where we are here with such a disparity between local and state government pay.
Okay. And, you know, I think probably at the state level as well and on the local level, workforces are dealing with an aging workforce, right? So, Sarita, how are retirements impacting the shortage, if at all, and what's speeding those up?
Well, it's interesting. So the 55 to 64 class or age group is actually increasing its labor force participation rate, both men and women. So that's not quite retirement age. That's like right before retirement. Right. But I think what we're seeing is folks who went into early retirement, which a lot of government folks have the opportunity to do, are coming back. They can't make the dollars stretch, or I like to say, you know, their wife said, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here kind of thing. And so I think, you know, we're seeing maybe a ramp up of that retirement age of that population coming back into the labor force.
You mentioned some folks retiring early. Any sense of why that happened?
Well, you top out in your para, and Casey's going to know the numbers better than I do, but I think it's somewhere around 26 years, and so you really don't have that incentive to keep working if you can afford to take your retirement and choose another line of work.
Any sense of whether the pandemic, you know, that was a stressful time for folks to be working, maybe particularly if they were on a short-staffed team. What role that had in losing folks, whether to retirement or leaving to a different position?
I don't know if we really seen an uptake in retirements during the pandemic. The main thing that really affected the people was a lot of overtime in these areas, like the essential, right? That was what they're categorized where they didn't get a lot of this federal grant money, right? In the city, once they're that category of essential, like water authorities, solid waste, and things like that. As things fell short in employees, might not have been looking for work because there was a lot of programs at one point, right, where they're able to stay on unemployment or whatever for a little while. So they really weren't going out to look for these other jobs, right? So that put a stress on the workforce where they these routes have to get picked up. The trash needs to get picked up. Your water needs to be on. I mean, the bus service kept on running. You know, and time away from your family, the more time away, it is a stressful thing, right? So a lot of people were choosing to either leave employment or try to find somewhere else if they could, right? Because they just, it puts a strain on the family at that point.
Oh, sure. Speaking of employee experience of this, right? You know, if we have a sense of the scope of the issue and what some of what's fueling it, as we just discussed, the end result is these hollowed out departments, right? So what are you all hearing about the experience on the ground of public employees? Casey, you just touched on this a little bit, but maybe I can ask you to expand.
Yeah.
What are you hearing from AFSCME members about what this prolonged staffing shortage has meant for them in terms of their experience at work?
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like to them like nothing's happening, right? I mean, I believe that the agencies are active in hiring, their hiring process and trying to get people out there, like the job fairs that we've been doing. But when somebody comes in new off the street, they're not lasting, right? I mean, some don't even make it off probation. Some been there a year or two. And with that overtime, like I'm saying, it stresses them out, right? I mean, they have other things they need to do at home, whatever it may be. But it doesn't, they don't stay long enough, right? So, I mean, if it's a 28% vacancy rate, two people come in, three people leave. You know, two more come in, five have left. And it's just something that you can't keep up with because of the overtime and, you know, the longer hours that they've had to work. So, I mean, so that's...
Yeah. Dylan, I believe that your department saw that a number of people, I think it was only, just over 60% of new employees were lasting through their probationary period, which resonates with what Casey's saying. Is there any sense of why that might be, why folks are seeking these jobs, getting these jobs, and then not sticking around?
you know, that is an area of concern, Nash, that we have generally with the state, that we don't have really pinpointed the exact reason for that. We have, you know, implemented exit surveys, so we're trying to find out a little bit more. We know that some employees bounce around to different state agencies, right? And so that would affect the probationary period. Also, you know, what we have been doing is focusing on training, right? To train both, you know, an older workforce wanting to come in, what we were talking about, trying to come back after retirement, or a young workforce without experience. And so we have we've focused really on managing skills for managers in our office, but also just basic training on computers, basic training on email. And so, I mean, that's what we were focusing on. But that is an area that we really are trying to focus on, is why probationary period employees are leaving. And just to understand what that is, when you first join state employment, for a 1 year you're a probationary employee, you don't get all of the protections that you would get if you are in the classified service, a classified employee. And so that's what we're talking about with probationary employees.
Thanks for clarifying that. Yeah, we're talking about folks who just recently started in these positions who are not hanging around. Well, thank you, Dylan, Sarita, Casey, for this conversation.
We're going to head right back to the roundtable now, but replacing Secretary Sarita Nair this time around is Patricia Tafoya Harris, the City of Albuquerque's acting HR director. In this conversation, the group explores possible solutions to the staffing shortages and hiring difficulties that have plagued the public sector.
Thanks, Lou, and welcome back to Dylan Lang, acting director of the State Personnel Office. Casey Padilla, president of AFSCME Council 18, which is across New Mexico and Colorado, and that's the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And welcome to our newest panelist, Patricia Tafoya Harris, the acting HR director at the City of Albuquerque.
Thank you for having me.
So now that we have kind of a grasp of the scope of the public employee shortage and how that's affecting government employees, I want to talk a bit about how it's impacting residents, right? So one easy example would be fewer bus drivers in the city of Albuquerque meant reducing bus routes this year. Dylan, can you speak to how those watching tonight are feeling the impact of these shortages?
Sure, maybe the local government could probably answer that question a little bit better than I, but you know, we do have a vacancy rate, but I think what we were talking about last segment, and at the state level, these positions are filled somewhat. We always want them to be higher, and we are seeing that, like with some nurses, direct care places, and so we're just asking employees to maybe work a little longer, harder, but we are supporting them with training. But that's what we're seeing at the state level. There are some shortages with correctional officers, but again, we are trying to support and get those positions filled quickly with rapid hires. But I'll defer to.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that we really are trying to be as consistent as possible and having reliable services within all of the services that we provide at the City of Albuquerque. And so in order to be consistent and reliable, we really rely on data to help us with determining how the impact of any change is going to make on our community population. And so we want to also be very mindful of something that Casey talked about earlier, is retaining our staff. So although we have historically deployed some methods of asking our team to work harder by doing some mandatory overtime, we're well in and past the pandemic. And so now's an opportunity for us to really look at how do we more effectively retain our employees and create the consistency of services that our community absolutely needs in order to get to work and to do the things that they rely on.
Yeah, so let's talk about the consistency of services piece. Mm-hmm. For Albuquerque residents, what does this actually look like on the ground, right? What is the impact on their everyday life that there are departments at the city that are short-staffed?
Right. So the intent is to utilize the data that we have in order to determine the services that are being most utilized, and we really focus in on maintaining that consistency and reliability of those services. And so what that really looks like to the community members is having our employees really help with maintaining the routes that we have in transit, maintaining the services for animal welfare and for senior affairs, making sure that we're delivering the meals to the sites that are necessary to make sure that our seniors are actually getting the meals that they so need to be healthy. And so it means using that data.
Are there places where that's not consistently able to happen, right?
Well, yes, Nash, thank you. Obviously, when there are shortages, there may be some gaps in services, but our teams are, and this is where we leverage the Ask Me's of the world to help us with making sure that our staff understands that the retention but delivery of these services are so necessary. Sometimes we do deploy methods of asking staff to help with covering those gaps so people are getting the meals or the transit resources that they need in order to get through their day-to-day lives.
Okay. Casey, can you talk a bit about those methods?
Yeah, I mean, utilizing overtime, I mean, the city, they try not to do that, right? I mean, at the end of the day, they try to not affect the employee's life, but at some point, right, the service has to get done, right? We have many people that do volunteer, right? Because it's a volunteer first and then they'll force. So they get an opportunity to pick what they want to do. So the services are getting done. I believe like in solid waste, it's getting done. We talk back, lean more to like the transit, the bus part. Is there's still the service being provided, but it's like a longer time you'd have to wait for that bus. So if the service was 10 minutes, now it's 20 minutes, right? Because the closer in time, you need the more employees, right? In transit, it's a double whammy. You know, it's just not a shortage on drivers. Now it's a shortage on mechanics, right? Because we're short in every area. And who's going to service these buses? Who's going to do these pre-trips? Who's going to put brakes? Who's going to rebuild engines? Who's going to do these things that these buses need, right? So an aspect, I mean, we could have a lot of drivers at one point, and then at another point, we wouldn't have the buses because they're not being able to get repaired, right? So, I mean, the services out there, I mean, they're utilizing buses, passenger vans, they're doing whatever they can to, you know, get the people where they need to go. But is there a lapse sometimes? I'm sure it's possible, right? I mean, I think they work on logging that stuff down and they're working on that data, as Patricia said. But I mean, a lot of that we really don't have yet because this is kind of a new thing, something that we had never experienced. And, you know, coming out of the pandemic, I mean, we're still working a lot of these things, trying to figure these things out, right? So.
Would you say that there are any particular communities that bear the brunt of these shortages? Is it spread across the board? Is it equitable? Or are there some disparities that you're seeing?
Well, I mean, I really don't know what shortages there would be. You know what I mean? I think, you know, like if you have parks, you know, some of the parks, they're put on for another day and maybe the grass won't get cut for a day or two longer, right? Instead of like a regular schedule. So as far as affecting on where it would affect it, I mean, I really couldn't really pinpoint somewhere that it'd be focusing.
Thinking about buses, right?
Yeah.
If you have a car, you don't have to take the bus, and so you're not going to be affected by that shortage, right? More often, low-income communities are going to rely on the bus more often. Are there other examples where there are particular communities in the metro area, in this case, where communities are disproportionately impacted by these services?
Yes, I think that's where the data is so incredibly important for us as a city, because we do utilize the data in order to help us to understand the utilization patterns, regardless of what city service that it's that we're providing. And obviously, our biggest commitment is to maintain services across our entire community. But that utilization data specifically helps us with understanding what patterns are being used in the different districts of the city. And we really make an active effort to have as much services as available. That data is critically important to understanding the utilization patterns.
Great. So you've got this data that you're collecting and looking at and trying to adjust to or respond to. I do want to shift the conversation into solutions here. I mean, I think that's so key if we're going to present the problem itself. So, Patricia, what is the city of Albuquerque up to in terms of responding to this problem?
Yeah, and really what we're talking about is staffing shortages, and that's making sure that we have the robustness of services regardless of what the department is or the position is. And so we have really started a campaign, we're calling it the hiring experience, where we're really evolving our practices within the human resources hiring processes in order to make our programming more efficient. We're taking a look at the qualifications required for jobs. We're looking at our job descriptions. We are looking at just the flow of applicants through our system, and it can be something as simple as a process. I'm very excited to announce that our transit department is actually having a hiring event on the 17th and 27th of this month at in our Daytona complex, and that's at 8001 Daytona. The neatest thing about this hiring event is we are literally going to take our applicants through the entire process in one day, so they could literally come in, apply for a job on site, and actually get offered and hired on site for the first time in the city's history. And these are practices that we believe are critically important to really fostering that quick hire process through. A lot of agencies, you're seeing statistics in the 60 plus days in time to hire. Well, we're really trying to drive that time frame down.
Because the longer it takes, you're seeing that folks bail on the process?
Absolutely.
Okay. And when you say that you are adjusting qualifications, adjusting job descriptions, in what way does that support? I mean, how are you adjusting it, and how does that respond to what you're finding is one of the issues?
Yeah, historically the city has had a very attractive applicant pools that come through for positions within the organization. And that has given us an ability through qualifications to have a screening process through that. Well, now when we've seen a reduction in applications through, we really need to make sure that we're identifying all qualified individuals that can effectively perform that job and the skills required in that job. And so we evaluate those qualifications to see, are we actually being too aggressive? So do we need to look at being leveraging experience more than maybe some of the educational requirements that have historically been in some of these jobs. So it's really being mindful of what's going to help us attract a qualified workforce to fill this gap.
Okay. And we talked in the last segment about pay being such a significant part of where the public sector struggles to remain competitive with the private sector. Dylan, what is the state doing to boost wages to better attract and retain employees?
I mean, wages is always something that comes up, for employee retention. I mean, but since 2019, the average pay for the state has increased 29%. So, I mean, the legislature and the executive branch, we've had a 6% and a 7% increase in pay for state employees. And so that's just the reality of the last 2 years. There may be another one coming. So we are trying to attack pay in that way, but also flexibility for individual agencies with flexibilities in the state personnel board rules, with temporary salary increases, with retention pay increases, or so we are being flexible in what we can provide with pay, but at a certain point, it just comes down to agency budgets, right? At a certain point, pay can't be the only solution, and so we're looking at a lot of these different retention the issues that the city of Albuquerque is dealing with, and we're doing the same things to get outside of just the pay, because I mean working in state or local government is different than the private sector. You have to buy into the mission, buy into the value that you provide to your community, and so that's where the retention piece comes in. It's you're not only motivated by pay. It's also compensation, but it's also really the mission, why we're here, public service, and why it's so attractive to a particular type of worker.
And something else that's uniquely different, at least especially here in the state of New Mexico, is state revenue is driven largely by the oil and gas industry, right, which is a boom and bust industry. So what happens when that bust comes in terms of being able to continue to follow through with raising these wages up for state employees?
That's something that we always have to consider, right? Budget will ultimately drive most of these decisions, and so that's why we have these tools available to us at the state level to increase salary, but only temporarily or have it come into the base salary. But ultimately, I think discussions at a state level and also goes to the local level has to be consistent and cooperative with Department of Finance, with the legislature and the executive branch and local governments to make sure that we are asking the right thing and asking for the right budgets and not just for positions and not just for anything else. So it's a continued effort every year to understand, hey, how can we make sure that we are providing services and how does that align with our budget request?
But yeah, so it's going to continue to be something that you have to respond to as things change. Casey, if I might, the amount of money in somebody's bank account isn't necessarily the only consideration, right, mm-hmm. for working for the government. What else makes these jobs appealing as careers?
Well, I kind of, like what he stated, you have to have buy-in, right? I mean, at the same time. But I mean, like the city of Albuquerque, and I believe also the state has a great benefit package, right? And I think that's what I myself got me to apply for the city 23 years ago was the retirement in itself, right? The medical for my family, for my kids, which I have like my grandkids on there now and stuff like that. And that's really the big part of it, right? And I think that's sometimes what we don't look at. Right, we look at the pay sometimes, which I think we could be more competitive, I think, in some areas. But I mean, it's just that the benefits that we actually, the city of Albuquerque pays 80% of our medical. They pay 75%, a little bit, and some change for retirement. You know, so those are some of the things that where that buy-in actually does come in, where we're offered that to where we want to hang around and put that career and be there the 25, 26 years that we are, you know.
Thanks, Casey, Patricia, and Dylan for this conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the podcast this week, and thanks to Nash Jones for all of their work. It's been a pleasure having them on the team this week. Now, be sure to follow our pages on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube throughout the week. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm senior producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, October 9th, 2023. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.